contrary to popular wishes, we haven't all been sentenced to a lifetime of going through Ulrich Grepper's source code, converting tabs to spaces. This is episode 8 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
As a reminder, we release a new episode every 2 weeks, always free, from TuxRadar.com, where we publish great news, features, and more, so bookmark it today. And especially this time, we have just put on sale a fantastic new magazine called Switch to Linux. It's perfect for all Linux newbies, all Linux newbie wannabes, people who want to switch, people who think they want to switch, friends you might want to switch, anything like that. Buy a copy today, buy a copy for your friend, buy a copy for your family, buy a copy for everyone. It's great. You can buy it online from tinyurl.com/linuxswitch. And of course, if you love the magazine that much, you can go to tinyurl.com/podcastlxf and subscribe to Linux Format for just $99 for 13 issues, a whole year of LXF goodness. In this episode of the podcast, OpenOffice.org 3.1 has been released. Glibc has been forked, the eGlibc. A ZNet reporter takes a crack at Moonlight and our open ballot, the most popular one so far. Do we need a standard package format? Stay tuned. It's that time of the century again, lads. OpenOffice.org 3.1 has been released.
I've only just finished starting 3.0.
What, are you compiling?
just yes. Booting it. Just all right. Running it, yeah. And yes. The splash screens appeared.
Yes. And apparently it's had a huge number of changes. Have you had a look at the changelog and any impressions?
Yeah, anti-aliasing for graphics objects.
Really?
At last.
Oh, yeah. That's a relief.
You know, text has been anti-aliased for a while, but now graphics.
500,000 lines of source code had to change for that.
Really?
500,000 lines.
Is that a change in like post-increments to pre-increments?
I don't know. I was thinking about it. For 500,000 lines, you could have thrown it away and switched to Cairo and written an operating system.
And written Cairo.
and converted to Emacs. You could have in half a million lines of source code. But yes, they could have switched to Cairo, and they've got anti-aliasing and OpenGL rendering and all this kind of nice stuff. The scary thing is, it makes you wonder how many lines of source code actually is 000.
Yeah,
if
yeah,
just
that
the
was
graphics
a small
drawing
change.
Bit is half a million, you know?
There isn't a number for that invented yet, no.
Maybe they were comments, that's
Google
all they
Google
changed.
Plexes. Well, possibly, yeah. That seems a bit...
We really must look at this bit.
Hack to do! This bit's really messy. But it also has really advanced features like translucent selections.
Yes, yeah. Now when you select text, it isn't just white on black. It actually has a proper highlighting colour as well.
It's amazing.
What happens if your highlighting colour was a nice translucent grey anyway?
It crashes. I don't even imagine.
What's the point in that? Is that to make it look more like Microsoft Word?
Cause it's looking easier on the eye, surely. Pretty as a feature, don't you know?
But I don't spend an awful lot of time selecting things, and when I do, I don't really care that it looks nice. I just want to know that it's selected.
Well, I think it's part of an overall drive to make the suite look better. Now, when you drag around objects like pictures, they appear kind of semi-translucent as well, instead of just being outlines as boxes.
I think that's really ungrateful of you to say that. That's 750 million lines of source code that they had to change to make that feature. You're saying, I don't really need it.
I'm sorry, Michael Meeks.
And they gave some examples. They gave some examples, some of the speed-ups, which I thought were incredible. One example changed from 24 seconds to 1.2 seconds.
Sweet!
Yes, but it raises lots of questions, I think, about OpenOffice.org. Right. Why was it 24 seconds in the first place, lads?
It doesn't matter now that it's 1.2 seconds.
Yes, well, yeah, but how many other ones like that are there?
But plot that on a graph.
Sleep 50.
plot that on a graph.
Yeah, half a million times.
Yes.
You start at 2.4, and then the next plot on the graph is 1.2. What's 3.2? That's going to be awesomely fast.
Oh, you're right. That'll be 0.0001 at this rate. Yeah. It's actually being included in Fedora 11, which is very cool.
Yeah, it's out in 3 weeks, I think.
3 weeks' time, yeah. So they're actually first on the ball again. In other news, this may make some people deliriously happy. It certainly makes me very happy. Glibc has been forked with eGlibc, which probably raises all sorts of reminders of EGCS in the past. I think it's great.
What do you mean forked with eGlibc?
There's now a guy from Debian who has created eGlibc, which is basically a copy
right.
At this point a direct copy of Glibc.
Right, I see.
With its own mission, of which mission number one is being polite, which I think is quite a good mission. But with other goals too, which is quite cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be better for embedded systems, because Ulrich Drepper, the lead developer of Glibsy, famously said that it was pointless supporting embedded crap, like ARM chips, which is a bit strange given that there are probably more ARM chips on the planet than all others put together.
Yeah.
Ulrich Drepper has been, he's obviously a talented developer, but his interactions with other developers have been rather curt and abrasive.
Is that a Debian guy?
Drepper?
Yeah.
No, he works for Red Hat. And, you know, he spent the last decade looking after Glibsy, and given how fundamentally boring a C library is, it's not really surprising he gets driven up the wall. But
his change logs are almost incomprehensible.
Yeah.
It's not because he's not trying, just because he's working in a very, very niche area. And you read through and you say, I have no idea what it was. It's better. I'm sure it's better. You know, he's a really, really smart and talented guy. But he's also abrasive, to put it politely.
Well, yeah, I had an entertaining 30 minutes going through some of those comments that you posted on TuxRadar, the link to the change logs.
Yeah.
Bug fixes.
Did you see the one where people like impersonating him? Just filming. Is that your final answer?
Will you change it for $1 million?
That was brilliant.
Yeah, he was almost a caricature of himself by the end of it, wasn't he? You know, please don't comment anymore. No.
Yes, but the sad thing is, he recently contributed a fix to Glibsy. I think it was 2.10. I've lost track of the numbers nowadays.
Well, that's part of the problem, isn't it? He hasn't been doing normal releases.
No, but in this, it's a really good feature he's put in. What happens now is when you run a program with a new library, it will auto-detect your CPU. Once,
when
you run a program, this time, in which case it crashes, it'll take the CPU and enable functions or enable certain code paths automatically, which I think is awesome, because most developers in the really high-end performance stakes have to fiddle with their code, say, okay, detect their own CPU detection code, their own CPU path optimized stuff, and that's lame, because in the new i7 chips, for example, there's actually hardware instructions for handling strings, doing things like string comparison or string length, whatever. There's basic C functions, and they're in the CPU now. And that's the kind of thing that will make a lot of programs faster. So he just put it into the C library. Detect, are we on Halem? Yes. Use the new stir comp or stir len, whatever, automatically. Oh, he's putting great features in, and now it's forked. Yeah. Thanks, Ulrich. Thanks for all the hard work. Here's a gold watch. Bye.
It doesn't sound like the fork is going to make him reconsider his attitude.
Well, like Paul mentioned the EGCS split before, where EGCS split off, it was seen as a small side project, and yet that became the standard.
That's GCC, compiler, by the way, for our newer listeners.
Yeah, and then X386, which forked into X.org when people were unhappy with the development process for that. And then the latter became the standard, so...
It might happen.
Yeah.
Moving on, Mozilla is considering updating the Firefox icon. Do we care?
Actually, I've been running, what is it? Is it Shire Topo?
Shiratoko.
Yeah, thanks. And it's got a blue icon.
Wow.
And it's really confusing because I can never find it when it's minimized in my taskbar. So I don't think it's a good idea.
Well, so at least it should be orangey.
Yeah. At least, yeah, based on the same theme so that it sticks out on
right. I think it means end of the earth.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's an obscure Japanese dialect from native people.
Yeah.
Now you know. I'm teaching you stuff.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Sweet.
Should we change icon or not?
Yeah, why not?
As long as you don't change anything daft, like...
Ice Weasel?
Yeah, that's just silly.
But did you see the Ice Weasel animated gif of it humping the planet?
Oh, no.
Poor little weasel. He abused.
Poor planet.
Well, according to the developers talking about it, they want to leverage the conceptual work done during Firefox 3, which makes me fully in support of it. That just sounds really good.
Yeah.
I would leverage. I think concentrating on their core competencies, though.
Like the Open Office team. Oh, I think it's looking a little bit tired. This episode's hot topic is in response to a ZDNet reporter saying that Moonlight sets a bad example by copying Microsoft, raising the question, does open source always need to be innovative? Does it always need to be the innovation rather than copying a core technology such as Microsoft Silverlight? His post on ZDNet got Miguel de Casa, the lead developer of Moonlight and head of the project, to respond to Dana Blackburn's claims that it was stifling innovation because we're open source developers were copying Microsoft. But anyway, Dana Dana, he says it's not the kind of open source story open source needs. It's the kind of open source success story that Microsoft wants to publicize. Microsoft innovates open source copies, according to Dana. Miguel de Caza responds to this by saying, this is about making sure that Linux, and for that matter any other system where Moonlight can be compiled, does not become a second-class citizen on the web. None of this matters when trying to access content on Linux. It's either possible to use it or not, and having a working relationship with Microsoft allows us to bring it to Linux. I personally don't agree. It's great that we'll be able to run Silverlight applications on the Linux desktop, but I just wish there was a better solution, a better open ISO-ratified standard that we could all use and everybody could develop on an equal platform.
I just don't get the premise of that ZDNet guy's argument. He's saying, right, so a technology exists, some free software programmers create an implementation, therefore it's just rip-offs. So we should never have GCC, because C was invented by other people. And then free software developers made it. A graphical desktop was invented by other people. Sure, copying goes on all over the industry.
Isn't the name GNU kind of implying that it's already ripping off something else? It's not Unix.
It's not ripping off something else. It's not Unix.
But that's it. The whole argument doesn't make any sense whatsoever. He's saying, oh, free software shouldn't copy anything, otherwise it's not being innovative.
I do think he's got a point with the Microsoft publicity campaign, that Microsoft could say, you know, Linux is following in Microsoft's footsteps. And it also gives Microsoft another chunk of user base for its own technology when something as important as this on the web should be more open, like HTML.
I don't think Microsoft would ever say that.
No.
Because what they're saying is, if you want this stuff, you can either buy it on our platform or get it for free the same on Linux. And that's a very dangerous thing to say, isn't it? You know, if they were to say, for example, you know, oh, OpenOffice.org 3.1 copies Office 2007 very closely, that's basically saying to them, don't buy Office 2007, go and use OO, it's the same and free.
Or it's saying, if you want the real deal, you have to pay for it. If you want something that's a couple of versions behind and doesn't properly work,
well, that was one of the things. That was one of the things that Dana
that seems to be the gist
pointed
of,
out
of his argument.
Yeah, that, well, there's Silverlight 3 coming out soon, apparently, which will be released shortly after Moonlight 2. So they're always going to be a step behind.
Well, surely they can just do a Mandriva with their version numbers and change it to, you know, Moonlight 2009.
Spring.
We're many, many thousands of versions ahead.
But the web has always been about open standards, interoperability, the fact that anybody can run a browser and view a site. I know it's been far from perfect over the years, but I think it's going the wrong direction. It's nice to have a project that brings us compatibility. Like, it's nice to have Ganache for chasing Flash, but, you know, it'd be nicer to have a better solution.
It would, and it'd be nice to have lovely prancing ponies in a sunny field.
I know, I mean, I don't want to criticise the work that Novell does in this. I mean, it's a very valuable project, and it's great that we've got the ability to run those apps, but I do see Dana's point. Dana, I say it in between.
You said Diana. That's definitely a girl's name. Yes, I think it's... But the problem is, if these guys want to go away and pay developers to work on Moonlight, great. Good luck.
Good luck, guys.
I'm not going to tell you to stop doing it. I'm not going to have a go at you. I think it's great they're working on it. And because without Moonlight, we wouldn't even have Silverlight 1. We'd have Silverlight 0. We'd have nothing at all. So I'd rather be one step behind Microsoft, you know, with compatibility with most sites, than have nothing at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to tell Miguel and his team, you know, don't do it. Because one thing Miguel did say in his response, quite correctly, is that by doing Moonlight, they're actually pushing dozens of other areas at the same time. They're testing things like Cairo or whatever to its absolute limits, because they're working on the very cutting-edge CVS all the time.
Mono development as well, presumably?
Yeah, of course, yeah. The whole thing's being pushed forward as a platform. It's not just Moonlight, so there's a lot of testing around dog food, which I think is very important.
I certainly don't agree with Dana's argument about everything open source has to be innovative, that we have to...
Well, that's a core argument, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I don't agree with that.
No. Most of open source isn't innovative.
No,
and that's fine.
It just doesn't have to be. No.
Most software in general isn't.
That's
exactly,
very true, yeah.
Exactly.
Making more of the same stuff, ideally better.
Yeah, and that's completely fine. And with the hot topic out of the way, that leaves us with just Discovery of the Week and, of course, our open ballot. Do we need a standard package format? Stay tuned.
All right, Discovery of the Fortnight, that was formerly known as Discovery of the Week until we realised it was wrong. I'm going to start off this month, or this week, or this fortnight. See how confusing it is, listeners. My discovery of the 14 days is Tiny Core Linux, which is a micro 10 megabyte distro. But it's 10 megabytes and includes a graphical desktop.
Wow.
Would you believe it?
How does it get the kernel into 10 megabytes?
I don't know. They must compile everything out. It doesn't even have Wi-Fi drivers in there. It boots up to a really plain graphical desktop with a JWM window manager and no programs. This loads entirely into RAM, 10 megs into RAM. And then you've got this small utility that lets you pull programs off the net using their own package format called TCE or TCX or something.
Right.
And then you can go and get stuff. There's hundreds and hundreds of programs.
Why is it installed into a RAM disk or
something? Yeah. So it's a completely stripped down Linux.
This means they've actually found a way to make starting OpenOffice.org slower. You have to download an 80 megabyte tarball first.
Yeah, but it is loaded into RAM, so the overall effect probably is quicker. But yeah, you've got, you know, there's Abbey Word, Samba, Opera, GCC, MPlayer in there. But you start from this 10 meg base. So there are a lot of light distros out there, like Zenwalk. But this is the most stripped down distro I've seen, because
10 meg is amazing.
I can't imagine how they've done it. You just bolt on the functionality that you need. You know, a lot of us spend time stripping bits out of distros, saying, how can I get this faster? This is cool. I think it'd be good for like kiosk systems, where you just want two programs and nothing else.
That sounds great. I'll have to give it a go.
Mm.
I found something called Net Video Hunter, which is, like last fortnight, it's another Firefox plugin. This one is particularly useful if you've got a patchy or intermittent internet connection, because it enables you to find videos on the interweb and download it to your machine. You just start playing the video, and then it pops up in the taskbar that it's Net Video Hunter has found an appropriate video, and then you can just a couple of clicks and it downloads the video to your desktop in Flash format.
Right, so it saves Flash movies.
It saves Flash movies, yeah. So
and you've checked with the Motion Picture Association of America beforehand that you could save that movie, yeah.
Of America? Why? Why would I do that?
I don't know.
Was it the British Phonograph Institute or that music?
Some guy, yeah. I checked with the guy, yeah.
Right, Graham.
This is thanks to Daniel James, who emailed me a link to this. And it was actually one of our hot picks, but I must have missed it.
You must have not read the magazine,
yeah.
You mean?
Yeah. Again.
Fail.
It's an application called Photox.
Photox?
And it's a really simple, straightforward, quick photo editor manager in the same kind of ilk as F-Spot or iPhoto.
Or K-Album.
Or it's much better than K-Album.
All right.
It really is. The best thing about it, it's really lightweight. Thumbnail views of all your photos are generated almost instantly. You can zoom in, zoom out of them, go to full screen mode, flick between your photos and process them. Red eye removal, perspective fix, HDR generation, panorama generation. All of this is from a single menu, a single click, usually a few parameters. You can see the changes reflected in your photo immediately. Click apply, it's done. It's just really streamlined, really easy to use, and the best way of editing photos I found, and if you've got a large photo collection.
Cool. Is it geared towards any particular desktop? Is it a KD app or a GNOME?
No, I tried to look. It looks more GTK based. It's not KDE.
Right.
It might not even be GTK, but it's just, there's no graphical frippery at all. It's just full screen image editing, using predefined effects, basically.
Awesome.
Now, just so I can feel clever and flex my amazing knowledge of free software,
yeah.
I believe Photox is rubbish. No, it's pretty good, but it only actually becomes good once you install an extra bit, I think it's called Printox or something, which makes it do printing. And then it's kind of better. It adds some features that Photox didn't actually have. Some fairly fundamental things for a photo manager, like printing, for example.
Oh, printing.
I think it's called Printox.
Right, yeah.
So it's like they've put it in 2% reason rather than 1. This is why I haven't tried it for the last 7 or 8 months, so I mean, it got better since then. But out of the box, it wasn't great. You had to add bits to make it better over time, which is...
Well, I quite like that approach to it, because I seldom print out photos, I must admit.
And finally, Paul.
So this is my discovery of the week, month, fortnight. Is something we mentioned previously very briefly on Tux Radar, and some commenters were saying, you know, what are you talking about? We don't understand. It's green profiles, which are frankly awesome, and they are new in Ubuntu 9.04. They're from the guys at Canonical. So they actually invented something again, which is good. And they haven't been making a great deal about it, which is a shame, because it's really, really ace. Basically, screen is, of course, GNU screen, the command line. Terminal multiplexer, to be technical, lets you run multiple terminals in one terminal, like having a multiple tabbed GUI thing, except there's no GUI required, so it's great for SSH connections. You have to open up four or five connections, open up one and have multiple terminals in that one. And it's great, but it's a bit hard for newbies to get into. They forget the commands, you know, control A, control N, whatever kind of thing. They forget those. What screen profiles does is provide a simple curses-based GUI around screen. So you get a nice little tab selection interface at the bottom. You can see what your tabs are. You can change the color schemes. You can make it show some information like a system load or your host name or a clock or whatever on the command line. You can press F9 and get a little menu up where you can add things or remove things or customize things. So it basically adds a really nice wrapper around screen that doesn't really do anything that new, but it makes it much easier to do things it did before that most of us couldn't really get the hang of. like you know, making it the tabs, whatever, they were always there, but you used to have to press a key combination to show the list of open windows and go from there, whereas now they're always there, always visible what program they're running.
It is like a window manager now, isn't it?
It is.
I've seen it and it looks awesome.
It's that good. It is. If you're a screen user, you really need screen profiles because it's so ace.
But it makes you wonder, why did this not come about before? You know, I think the screen's probably been identical since Unix in the 70s, and now suddenly it looks great.
I totally agree, but the thing is, for a long time, people who should have been using screen weren't using screen.
Yeah.
They would just log in multiple times using SSH or whatever, weren't using it, because it's a bit of a black art, all the key combinations, getting it just right. And really all you need is, you know, create C, N for next and the numbers to jump around. Really, it's all you need. But there are many, many, many more. So finally, someone at Ubuntu's clearly caved in and thought, okay, we can reveal this wonderfulness to the masses by making it easy for a change, which is what Canonical does best, really, isn't it?
So I wonder what's next in the pipeline for upgrades then. Sed, you know,
Ed. Oh, that'd be so nice, wouldn't
Orc.
It? Yeah.
Autocomplete on Sed. That would be nice.
The regular expressions.
We think you're trying to match email addresses. Yeah. Who knows? Obviously, you can do customizable autocompletions really easy in Bash. Using functions. I think we've done a tutorial on it on TuxRadar, actually, and in Linux format, so it's not hard to do. So it's extensible. You know, maybe autocomplete configure. God knows. Who knows? But anyway, there's other options. We'll see. But it's a great step forward, and I think more of the same, please, lads. Thank you very much.
This fortnight's open ballot has probably generated the most, well, probably, it's definitely generated the most feedback of any that we've done so far. We've had 119... responses so far, and counting at time of writing, and other caveats. The question that we asked is, do we need a standard package format? Now, that's because Linux has RPM, it has Debs, it has tarballs if you're using Slackware, it has auto packages, it has a plethora of other different ways of getting software installed onto your machine. And, you know, some people think that it's too many. I know that Mike has experienced package rage.
Ah!
Yes. In his professional capacity as a DVD editor, compiling software from all sorts of sources, making sure that the dependencies are all right. But we want to know whether you think it's a big deal. Should we have to standardise on one package format, or is the present state of anarchy okay for you? Mike, what do you reckon?
I think a huge 140-point yes. Look. Freedom and choice is good when it comes to browsers and office suites and programs. Oh, I want to try this one, try that. But really basic stuff, fundamental system level stuff, you don't want loads of incompatible versions. You don't want lots of different versions of ifconfig. You don't want loads of different versions of the kernel. You want some standardization at the base level.
I'm sorry, but what are you going to do with your time if the package is just installed when you click on it?
This is true.
I mean, you'll have so much spare time that, you know, you'll just get bored and, you know, leave the job and go and find something else to do. Linux is all about filling in time that we'd spend thinking about our own mortality We have to work hard. We have to find those dependencies. We have to fix build errors just to use a simple package that we're only going to run once and then never go back to again. That's the whole point of Linux.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you're using Linux as some sort of surrogate for a Protestant work ethic. But that also seems to be where Dave S. is coming from. He says, no, we shouldn't have a standardized package format because that would make things easier for everyday users and make geeks seem less clever. And that would never,
totally agree.
In caps,
yeah.
Do.
Yeah.
So basically Linux is some sort of protectionist racket.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. It's keeping geeks busy. Keeping them off the streets.
But geeks could be busy in making OpenOffice.org
no,
even faster.
Talentless geeks.
Well, our very own Mayank Sharma says, absolutely, that's yes, we should standardise on one package format. Not only will it be simpler for users, it'll also save app developers and packages loads of time. Presumably that'll free them up to make more apps or you know, fix...
Do some gardening.
The guy who likes Linux says, come on, this is what everybody has been waiting for. And Sline says underneath, and .deb is the way to move forward. If we're going to standardise on a package format, you know, should we standardise on Deb?
I think we have already standardised on the package format. Says the LSB that no one listens to.
The most effective.
And it wasn't Deb; it was RPM.
It was RPM, wasn't it?
They kind of chose the wrong horse, and I guess they're trying to hope everyone forgets about that choice. My idea, I think I've got a great idea, as usual. Why don't we have an all-in-one package format? Because basically, inside your package, inside your RPM, or inside your deb file, you've got the files inside the package, inside the application, all the binaries, all the documentation, whatever, and then about 2 kilobyte, 3 kilobyte of control files that says, in Debian's case, you know, depends upon, suggests, recommends, da-da-da. And it's the same thing for RPM as well. So why can't we just take those 2K of control files from the RPM thing and put that into a file, then take the 2K of stuff for .deb and put that into the file, and then put the same binary stuff that is unchanged between the two packages into the file. So the same thing works for RPM and deb.
Because you'll still have problems with whatever version of the distro you're running. People running older versions of Red Hat or the newer versions of Red Hat still will have dependency problems.
Ah, yes, but we're not talking about do we need to fix dependency problems. We're saying do we need a standard package format?
Yeah, there will still be those problems with software management, but as a first step, having everybody working together on a single package format would be great.
So you basically, for any program, you'll get a file you can download. And as long as you're running a relatively recent distro, you know, without, you know, GCC 2.96 or some crap like that, it should just work. That's a big step forward, I'd say.
The rest of the internet, while dying from swine flu, says... Well, person B says, nobody needs a unified format. Everyone should just use Alien to convert packages to their native format if the owners can't be bothered to package it properly. Different distros choose their package managers carefully. Each one has its pros and cons. One more thing, Yum is written in Python. Take that, Paul.
I loved that comment. I read that through and thought, yes, having used Yum recently a great deal, have you ever wondered why Yum is so hideously slow?
Oh, stop.
It's because APT uses binary blobs for its data cache and uses C, so super fast, whereas Yum uses XML and Python, which is a recipe for disaster.
Graham, you can cut that.
I'll stop there.
That old chestnut freedom of choice comes up several times in the no camp. So there's no real point.
How many of those were from Richard Stallman?
He's I think he writes under Anonymous Penguin these days.
Oh,
so
right.
It's hard.
Anonymous GNU / Penguin.
Hard to really count them up. Joachim Ganser says it would be insane to standardise on one format. We need two formats to compete, otherwise no or little progress will be made.
Progress?
What progress is that?
Don't interrupt Joachim.
Sorry.
Look at KD.
Sorry, Joachim.
Look at KDE and GNOME. None of them would be what they are without the other. Competition is good. That's exactly what we were saying about Chromium the other day, that it's pushed Firefox to get faster.
Yeah, KDE4 wouldn't be quite so good without GNOME.
What features does he want to see added to Deb?
Shall I ask him?
Wait. it's already got suggested packages, recommended packages, might be nice packages.
OpenGL.
Have you considered these? OpenGL, yeah. Like a visualizer.
Yeah.
Now installing, like getting the Matrix.
Yeah, it shows the bytes flying onto your hard drive.
I'd actually really like that. another yes from Taoist Totty. Hello, Taoist Totty.
Hi.
He or she says, I would say yes, but I can see the problem of having the different files for different distros. So how about a compromise? A single file format, but one that can be limited to specific distributions. That doesn't actually sound like a single file format, does it?
It does not compute.
Oh, well. And probably the final word from the internet should go to Istvan, who says, yes, we should have a standard package format, and it should be ended with .exe.
Lols.
Or DMG.
Yeah. Yeah, that works very well.
I like, I don't know if he's done it on purpose, but there's a sort of a brilliant St. James Bible-style euphony to his choice of words there. Yes, and it should be ended with .exe. It's almost like, you know, you will know him by the file extension of the beast.
I have one more great idea for this, by the way, which I think would maybe help solve problems at least partly. Metalink, you know Metalink?
Yeah,
The download file format.
Yeah, I did read that one.
Okay, you read that one. Yeah, we covered it in the Nuts format a while back, and so the idea is you've got torrents to a download, you've got direct links, you've got FTP, whatever. Metalink is one file format in XML that basically encapsulates all the possible download possibilities for this file and lets you choose locally on your client how you want to download it. I think we could do that for packages, so that users just see, click here to install, it downloads a little file, a .meta install or whatever, which looks in the machine, says, okay, you're running Ubuntu 9.04, that means you want a deb file, and then it downloads a deb file and installs it. The user doesn't have to see deb or RPM, they just see click here to install.
I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, I should get paid for this.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
Well, there was quite a common thread on in the Tux Radar responses, that if there were a proper user interface for Alien, we wouldn't need to standardize on one package format. We could just have one graphical front end for X number of packages.
Ah, so if PackageKit had Alien built in,
yeah,
so you wouldn't care. The end
user wouldn't need to know.
But they'd still see an RPM, wouldn't they? It's a deb and a tar GZ or whatever.
Well, they'd see it in what sense?
What's an RPM file? At least with a .exe this guy recommends, everyone knows that's a double-click install. Mm. Set up .exe. Or is it .msi, I think, for a new install stuff? Anyway, it's an extension that just works across all the things. Whereas they see RPM and see .deb, then they're not really sure what it does.
But if Alien were built into your package manager,
yeah, exactly,
you wouldn't need to see RPM or .deb.
Say it's on the website. Someone would give you RPM files on a disk or on the website, whatever, you'd still see .rpm and think, oh, what's that?
But then if your distro was set up so that any .rpm or .deb file were opened in Alien.
Yeah, yeah, it worked. That's good too. My idea's better, of course, but
yeah,
it's still good.
Of course.
And with such grand designs, we come to the end of our podcast, episode 8. Thank you very much for listening.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, nobody cares, Paul. Right, one last.
And with that, we come to the end of our podcast episode.
Thing. Can you hear me, listeners? Who do you really want to hear? I bet you want to hear this one last thing. Now, some people know this, but not everyone. In Linux, directories have to be executable for you to navigate into them. They have to have the executable permissions bit set before you can go into them. If you try to go into a directory that's not executable, you'll get permission denied errors. So if you ever find a folder inaccessible and for the life of you can't work out why you can't get into it, it all looks normal otherwise, fire up your file manager, check the permissions, and make sure that the executable bit is set. And I'm sure someone in the comments can explain why, give a sound technical explanation why it needs to be executable before you can go into a directory.
Surely it's just to save bits, isn't it?
But the bit's already there, isn't it?
Yeah, surely there's the read bit anyway.
Well, no, because you have to be able to read the list of files in the directory,
yeah,
and get into the directory are separate permissions, aren't they?
I guess it's more like the directory is just a special kind of file.
Yeah.
So to be able to open the directory, you need to execute it.
There you go.
Why?
I think basically...
Why, if you've already got a read bit for it?
Because it's a file. You can read the file and see it.
No, because you can still see, you can have a file that hasn't got the rebit.
What I'm saying
still
is they could add another bit, but that just wastes space, doesn't it? They could just reuse that existing bit, couldn't they?
I don't know why they don't just need a read bit. If the read bit's set, you can't go into the directory.
But because the read bit's there to say, you can get into the directory, but you can't read the files. You can list the file names only. I think there's read, list, read, write, can't even get into as four possible options. So there you go.
Yeah, there's the solution.
And maybe I'm wrong. There's still a chance for listeners to wade in and provide your comments in the podcast notes. And with that debatable topic, it comes to the real end of our podcast, episode 8. Thanks very much for listening. Don't forget our awesome subscriptions deal for Linux Format Magazine at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. All the notes for this podcast, whether you like it or not, are on the website. And tune in 2 weeks' time. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.